Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Every year on or near Earth Day, we check in with writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. He's author of Bargaining for Eden, The Fight for the Last Open Spaces in America, and many other books. In past years, we've focused the program on Bears Ears, Great Salt Lake, transition to younger leaders in environmental justice, 30 by 30 land preservation proposal, and many other topics. This year, we're going to take stock of conservation on Utah's public lands. We're going to ask some key questions. What has been accomplished? How is that success achieved? And what happens next? So we do welcome in, as always, Stephen Trimble. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Tom, as always. There's always a lot to talk about.
Yeah, so circumstances were 2 days past Earth Day, but happy Earth Day. So we're also joined today by Scott Groney, who's recently retired as Executive Director of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So congratulations, I guess, right, on retirement. You're able to do other things.
I think so far I've spent about 40 nights sleeping out. So
oh, yeah. Nice. And we're also joined by John Ruppel, director of Wallace Stegner Center's Law and Policy Program at University of Utah. John Ruppel also served as senior counsel in the White House Council on Environmental Quality during the Biden administration. John Ruppel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
I guess you're still working, so those 40 nights under the stars, they'll have to wait a bit for you?
Yeah, those are aspirational nights.
Yeah, right.
Those are future nights.
But hopefully you're able to spend a few nights under the stars at this point. Let me just start with some of your personal involvement in conservation, public lands work. So I'll start with Stephen Trimble. How did you get involved in conservation, public lands work?
Oh, it's a big question for an old guy. I fell in love with the canyon country of Southern Utah, really as a kid on family vacations from Colorado. And then later went to college and joined the Sierra Club. It was the end of the 1960s and everybody was thinking about saving the world, saving the earth. It was the first Earth Day in 1970. And I did what the Sierra Club bulletin told me to do. I wrote letters to try to save the Escalante from road development. Did everything I was told to be a good conservationist by my elders. And then eventually came to Utah, worked as a park ranger at Archers on Capitol Reef, started writing and photographing and donating my pictures and writing to conservation organizations. And I've been doing it ever since. And that canyon country, that slick rock country, really feels like my spiritual home. So I work very hard as a writer. I figure it's my job to speak up in his defense.
Let me turn to Scott. How did you get involved in the conservation public lands work?
Well, I went to law school out of an interest in defending public lands, although I was pretty naive about how that was going to play out. I don't think I actually had ever talked to a lawyer before law school. But what specifically happened is I was working down in Alcheta, which is across the river from Mexican Hat, representing people in San Juan County under the poverty line. And in my free time, I was fighting a mine up on Lime Ridge and came across in a documents request a letter from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And that ended up working out very well for me in terms of getting me involved in these issues.
Mm-hmm. John Ruppel, same question to you. How did you get involved in this conservation public lands work?
Yeah, for me, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest during the timber boom and then the timber bust. And I remember flying over the Cascades, going to visit grandparents, look out the window of this plane, and you'd see these massive clear cuts. And you'd see this crystal blue river that would turn brown from sediment below the clear cuts. And I remember looking at that as a little kid, maybe 8, 9, 10 years old, and kind of being really confused. It was clear that logging at that scale in that way just wasn't sustainable. We were losing something really important. But growing up through that era in that place, I also saw the human side of the bust and what it means when a community, or to a community, when a mill closes. So the suffering had a face, and the pain and the people that were experiencing it was very real. So I kind of really struggled to kind of make sense of that. And I think I owe a lot to a book by by Charles Wilkinson called Crossing the Next Meridian, because it helped me connect kind of history and law, humanity, land ethics, and the sense of place, and start to make sense of some of those issues. So, you know, that led to law school, and here I am, kind of a wild-eyed pragmatist, you know, believing that we're all entitled to clean air, breathe. We're all entitled to clean water and wild places to explore. So I think that's kind of a motivator for me, but also recognizing that people can't be left out of our conservation decisions equation. As far as Southern Utah, that fascination for me began probably in 1993-ish, when I did my first trip down around Moab, and it's just grown over time as I've gone deeper into the backcountry there and spent more time on the San Juan River and up in Cedar Mesa and around Bears Ears. So, you know, it's really a special place.
Mm. I want to follow up with you, John. Most people are probably familiar with Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Some may not be familiar with the Stegner Center's Law and Policy Program. What do you guys do there?
Well, the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment, it's part of the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. So basically, you can think of the Stegner Center as kind of the hub for our environmental law program. As we try to extend environmental law beyond simply classroom education for our law students. So we offer public programs like our annual symposium, lunchtime talk. So you know, this year our symposium was on air quality. Last year it was on Gray Salt Lake. Next year it'll be on public lands. We also offer, or we have a couple of programs. We have an environment dispute resolution program. We have a Great Salt Lake initiative, and then the law and policy. I lead the law and policy team. And you can think of us as kind of a nonpartisan group of lawyers whose mission is to promote sustainable public land and environmental decision making through objective scholarship that others can then use as they develop their environmental policies and programs. So we're basically a team of pragmatists, and we're trying to promote informed legal decision making.
All right. Well, Scott Groney, as I mentioned, you just retired recently as director of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. So in your farewell, I'm going to quote you. You wrote, "I imagine Sua as a mythical desert river flowing through time. There's no guidebook for this river. Its flows are unpredictable. Every bend, every season brings new views and challenges. Many have paddled it in the past, and there are uncharted miles ahead of us." So that's the long view, right? But I wonder how you feel about leaving that central role, and it's amounting to a pretty precarious time.
Well, I had planned my departure for 2 years. But I think, like what you just read, I have really had no trouble leaving. I have, you know, full confidence in the Utah Wilderness Movement that it has arisen over the last 20, 40 years. And I also, I'll be honest, I have great faith in my friends and colleagues at SUA, who are skilled and I think pulled together as a terrific team to defend these lands. And then there's the reality of it's never about the individuals. It has to be a movement where the individuals work together for something bigger. And in this case, it has to be actually a national movement. And so stepping aside is just leaving room for, you know, the new folks to step up and do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for you, Scott. You know, SUA is known primarily for litigation. You guys are fiercely, powerfully effective in the courts. But I know you do a lot of other things in terms of being out on the land, knowing the Utah wilderness better than any other organization, having volunteers. I mean, what does it really take to move forward to accomplish things like the big successes you've had in the past in Washington County or Emory County? You know, how does it happen?
I think part of SUA's strength is that it does so many things well, that it has an office in Washington, D.C., that it has organizers in Utah and in other states, that it has skilled litigators, that it has people in the field leading volunteers, that it does have the knowledge of what's going on the ground better than anyone else. And so with the capability to do everything, the organization can shift with political changes, and it can endure long term. Political change takes years. And so an organization has to have the capacity to endure for years, as well as survive and thrive with changes, and be ready to take advantage of opportunities that arise. And I think SUA is really strong at that. Speaking of someone on the outside now.
I just want to follow up with that, Scott, before we go over to John to talk about approaches, kind of some different approaches to conservation. So because of, SUA's fierceness, you guys are kind of one of the top demons from the other, those on the other side. So how do you work with folks who are so suspicious of your work?
Well, I think anytime you're faced, say, with a decision-making process, you know, the first thing you look for is there a common interest? And sometimes there are, for example, with land exchange bills. If you can't reach agreement because there's no common interest, then you try to negotiate. That is, we disagree, but can we make some swaps? What's difficult on this is that in Utah, it's often not the representatives of industries at the table, oil and gas or mining, which honestly can be easier to negotiate with than the players in Utah, which tends to be the politicians. And the problem with the politicians is it's often unclear what they actually want beyond proving their toughness ideologically. You look at an issue like Morris 2477, there's no practical reason why the state continues to spend millions and millions of dollars. But we're in this trap that the politicians have to continue to act tougher than everyone else. But that makes it really difficult to negotiate when one side doesn't really know what they want. The other thing I'd throw in is often the personalities really matter in these conflicts. Stephen had referred to the bills that have passed for wilderness. You know, with Cedar Mountains, at that time, Rob Bishop was a really reasonable person to work with, and he was trying to block nuclear waste coming in the state and was willing to barter for wilderness to do it. With the Washington County legislation, former Senator Robert Bennett at some point just decided he really wanted to pass legislation and was willing to break some china to do it, including undermining the county commissioners. With the Emery County bill, you had these negotiations between Senator Durbin and Senator Hatch, but you had a key staffer in Hatch's office that was really important to make that happen. And so as you go down this thing, can you agree? Can you negotiate? You also have to look out, is there someone on the other side that will open the door in a way you may not expect?
Let me turn to John Ruppel. Similar question. You, of course, all approaches needed, right? And welcome. So we're talking about, you know, SUA's approach, but you come at conservation a little more as a scholar. It also serves as advisor to the president, right? The senior counsel of the White House Council on Environmental Quality during the Biden administration. Can you give us an example of a conservation success you helped with and how that happened?
Sure. And I really want to echo some of Scott's comments. I think finding that common interest is crucial. And I really like his comments about land exchanges. Hopefully, maybe we can circle back to that at some point, because I see those as an opportunity to advance a whole range of issues and do good for a very broad segment of the public. But, you know, to your question, I guess I'm kind of a reluctant scholar in state government and private practice. Before that, before I went to law school, I worked in an environmental consulting firm. And as you say, I had the privilege over the last couple of years to work in the Biden administration. So my experience has taught me to see problems, I think, from a lot of different perspectives, to hopefully be able to step back and hold that issue in your hands and kind of twist it around and look for those opportunities and those interests and those points of negotiation. And it's also taught me that there are only team victories. So I completely agree with Scott's comments that it's never about individuals. It's always about the team. And when I think about what works and where
weed ground, at stagnant ground. We're institutionalists. And I think we have kind of four guiding principles. The first is that a decision, whether it's around public lands or resources elsewhere, it has to be grounded in the rules. So that doesn't mean the law is perfect. If you don't like the law, people can work to try and change it. But we don't place ourselves above or outside of the law. We stick within the rules. The second is, I think decisions have to be supported by the best available science and information. Vibes don't count. Assumptions need to be questioned. Let's stick to the facts, stick to the science. Third, I'd say, you know, decisions need to be made in an atmosphere of transparency. It gives voice to all of those that are affected. So the public needs to see it. They need to understand it in order to have trust in the outcome of the decision. And then we just need to be kind and humble. You know, again, I agree with Scott's comments. Sometimes the tone in Utah politics can be pretty intense. And, you know, I think it's hard for sometimes folks in the federal government to work with the state government when the state is, you know, constantly poking them in the eye. So there's an opportunity here to find maybe a kinder dialogue. In terms of accomplishments, one thing I'll highlight really quickly is something folks in Utah may not have heard about, but it involves the Elk River Valley up in Canada. So the Elk Valleys in British Columbia, it's an area where you have, you know, about half a dozen of these just massive scale open pit mines. These mines discharge a number of pollutants, including selenium, which is a neurotoxin. It gets into the water and then it flows down across the border into the United States, into Montana, Idaho. And the U.S. and Canada have been kind of struggling to deal with this for decades. And the Biden administration had a breakthrough. They were able to bring together Canada, the United States, British Columbia, Idaho, Montana, and a coalition of six Native American tribes and Indigenous First Nations in Canada, and forge an agreement to work with what's called, work under the Boundary Waters Treaty and bring together what's called the International Joint Commission and build this framework to start addressing this problem, struggling with for decades. And, you know, it's really a testament to finding those common interests, being able to negotiate, and hopefully doing good in ways that are going to have lasting.
Your mention of working with Native folks, John, makes me think of Bear's Ears, of course. And I was doing some volunteer writing for SUA at the beginning of the Obama administration, when there was a lot of energy around doing something to expand canyon lands. And then the Bear's Ears Intertribal Coalition came along, you know, these tribes that came together historically with the idea of Bear's Ears National Monument. And the energy shifted, and the conservation community kind of turned over that fight for Bear's Ears to the tribes. It was really historic, and nothing like that had happened before. Could either of you talk a little bit about the shift toward recognition of Indigenous voices? I know that was a new thing for SUA, right, Scott?
Actually, I don't think it was. I think we had
I love being corrected.
The local chapters, the local Navajo chapters, as well as with the Tribal Preservation Office with the Hopis. But I kind of wanted to go back to something, which is the reality is while we have to try to see if we can reach an agreement with folks, often in Utah, that is not what happens. It often comes down to a fist fight. And the advantage, I mean, to deal with the Utah congressional delegation, you have to be able to demonstrate that you can stop them or they won't take you seriously. And so if there's some hope to get to the negotiating table, it is only if you can demonstrate the political power that they can't run around you. And that's what Utah activists have done for years. That it used to be the Utah congressional delegation would try to introduce bills once or twice. A Congress And they've stopped doing that because they realized that women's advocates in Utah could block them. So I just want to go back. So particularly with the Trump administration, we can't kid ourselves. Negotiation is going to work here. It is going to be a fight in the courts and with organizing and in the Congress. Now, going back to your point, Steve, things have really dramatically changed with the tribes. SUA did have a history of working on site-specific decisions with the local Navajo chapters, primarily in Utah, as I said, with the Hopis. But with the Bears Ears, SUA was trying to back the tribes as well as we could, respectively, but then also went to seek the tribes' endorsements for America's Red Rock Wilderness Act to protect over 9 million acres. And so it speaks to the power of the tribes that when the Navajo Nation, the Hopi tribe and the Zuni Pueblo have all now endorsed wilderness for that much land in Utah. It's really moved the sort of the dial forward to protecting these lands. Mm.
John, you may want to jump in on the question of the tribes. I want to, before you do that, I want to talk about approaches, follow up on approaches. So Scott has described the power of activism, right, and it's sort of tough activism, demonstrating to elected officials that you could actually stop them, and that'll get them to the negotiating table. Earlier, you talked about maybe trying to find a kinder dialogue. I wonder if you'd talk about the role, again, all roles needed, right, but the role of maybe, you know, scholarship and dialogue in achieving some of these goals.
I think in some ways, discussions when we're talking about public lands, and I agree with almost everything Scott said, negotiation requires a willing counterpart, and that's been a challenge in Utah. But I think our role as scholars is often to help ensure that we're working from a kind of a common or shared factual ground, right? To try and to the extent we can make sure that there's a common verifiable set of facts about some of these key issues. So we did work 5-6 years ago about prior reductions to national monuments, to go out and dig through the archives to understand what had been done before, see if there was any precedent for what President Trump tried to do in his first administration in reducing barriers and the Grand Staircase. And the short answer is Trump stood alone, that there was nothing comparable out there in history in terms of kind of the motivation behind those reductions. And I think being able to provide that information is valuable because people can then use that in a discussion. They can go back and fact check our work. They can confirm, you know, what we did, and they can say, no, these actions stand alone. And that then fits into the question of, well, where does the president find authority to act in the way he tried to do before? Does he find it in the Constitution? Is it somehow implied by the Antiquities Act? Is it somehow implied by prior practice? And then we can hopefully work from kind of a better understanding of facts and the law. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. Thank you. So we need to head toward a break. Before we do that, Stephen, I want to, we have a SUA, right? Activism, advocacy, scholarship represented by John. What's the role of a writer in all of this?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me that, Tom, because I was thinking about this idea of softer activism, and that leads me back to the two books of essays that I've helped to edit and put together at moments of great crisis for Utah conservation. In 1995, Terry Tempest Williams and I put together a little book called Testimony and invited all of our writer friends to write impassioned short essays about why we needed to preserve the wildness in southern Utah. And we took that to Washington, D.C. and distributed it to every member of Congress and to the decision makers. And eventually it helped lead toward President Clinton's establishment of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And then 20 years later, I worked with Kirsten Allen at Torrey House Press in 2016 to put together a second book of essays that included many more younger voices, many more Native voices. We called it Red Ruck Testimony, and did the same thing and went to Washington and lobbied Congress and made sure that those voices and those words reached the desks of the decision makers. And actually, interestingly, both times people started telling us, you need to talk to CEQ, you need to talk to the Council on Environmental Quality, the environmental advisors to the president, which we really hadn't thought of doing. At some point, I'd like to just ask John, what is CEQ and how does that work? But I think that was our role. That's the role that we decided to emphasize and take on in adding our voices to the mix, to the decisions leading toward these big actions of conservation.
Just before we go to break, John, just very briefly, what is CEQ?
Sure, it's a great question. Most people aren't familiar with CEQ. Those that are think of it as the entity that promulgates regulations to implement NEPA, or the National Environmental Policy Act. But essentially, it's an office within the executive office of the president. Its job is to help inform the president about environmental matters, help the president develop policies, and then help the president then implement those policies. Often, like I said, it's been focused around NEPA and environmental impact review. But in the prior administration, I think that the reach was maybe a little broader, that, you know, we were engaged on some of those questions about public land management. We were engaged on some questions about energy development and, you know, how to strike a balance. So I think the short answer is that the scope of the office can change really dramatically depending on the administration. But, you know, the mandate is very broad. It's an office that can provide information about a whole host of issues and help kind of herd the cats, to work with all the various federal agencies and try and get them moving in the same direction around a set of issues, whether that's, you know, public lands, whether that's about plastics, whether that's about habitat connectivity, whether that's about energy development. It really has a kind of a broad mission.
All right, let's take a break here. We're talking, this is our Earth Day program, a couple days late this year, but we usually honor Near Earth Day every year. We check in with writer and photographer Stephen Treble. He is with us. And today we also are talking with Scott Groney, who recently retired as the executive director of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And we're talking with John Ruppel, director of the Wallace Stegner Center's Law and Policy Program at University of Utah. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today is our Earth Day program. Every year on or near Earth Day, we check in with writer and photographer Stephen Treble, and we do various topics related to conservation and related topics. This year, we're asking, what's the state of conservation on Utah's public lands? What's been accomplished? How has that success been achieved? What happens next? The last about 20 minutes of the program here, we're going to focus on that last question, what happens next? So in addition to Stephen Treble, we have with us Scott Groney, who recently retired as executive director of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and John Ruppel, director of Wallace Stegner Center's Law and Policy Program at University of Utah. So I'll direct this first to Scott Groney. Where do you think conservation in Utah is headed? Reasons for optimism, opportunities, where are things headed, do you think?
Well, I think with public lands in general, that there's this pendulum that swings back and forth with administrations. And, you know, in the past, Utah wilderness advocates have been able to make this steady progress. That there was a study done by Center of Western Progress a couple of years ago, and they looked at gains across the American West. And the two states that in the previous 20 years had made the most gains politically were California and Utah. And the report pointed out sort of the strangeness of Utah with its politicians' hostility towards public lands protection had accomplished so much. And that is simply because of this movement that's been built by interested people that love these lands. You know, we may be facing a crisis now beyond anything we've seen. The first Trump administration tried to tear down the agencies that manage these places. They ship people out of D.C. out to Western offices, you know, with a not so, it was transparent. They were trying to force people to quit. And now we see they're going to take additional steps that it's not just they're going to make bad decisions. They're going to try to actually decimate the agencies that make the decisions. And this is when litigation will come in to try to level the playing field to stop these illegal decisions. I think what's coming now, the one thing to remember is that even in Utah, the history sort of shows this great arc towards protection, regardless of these swings back and forth. And I think it's also worth looking at the two sides. On the one side, you have this movement of folks in Utah and across the nation that have pulled together time and time again. On the other hand, you've got this coalition driven by fear. You know, whether it's in Congress, the executive branch, Trump has not pulled together a coalition of people that care about the same things. He has just scared the dickens out of them. And so you've got the Utah congressional delegation that is now cowed by him. But that doesn't make for a very strong coalition politically. It will last only as long as Trump can legitimately threaten people in their political careers. So a lot of tough fights ahead, but I have my faith in a movement that's built on love for these lands, not just a bunch of characters that are afraid they'll lose their political offices.
John Ruppel, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's really important to emphasize that what the Trump administration is trying to do is not what the people want. You know, the Colorado College State of the Rockies poll and a series of polls by the Grand Canyon Trust repeatedly come up with these astonishing figures. You know, 84% of Utahns support establishment of new national parks, national monuments, and protected areas. And across the West, 89% of voters oppose reducing or removing national monument protections. You know, what they are trying to do is not what we want. We, the people, want. And, you know, when the Utah congressional delegation says, this is what Utah wants, it's not what Utah wants. You know, there was a great anecdote I heard from Tim Peterson at the Grand Canyon Trust recently, that when Trump came to eviscerate Bears Ears in Grand Staircase at that sort of theatrical moment in the Utah State Capitol at the beginning of his first administration, he said, oh, this is not going to be controversial. And of course, we all just rolled our eyes here in the conservation community. And what Tim said recently was, Trump had no idea how controversial it was, and he later got really angry with the Utah politicians for not telling him. So there's this huge dichotomy between this growing movement that Scott talked about, really supported by people, and what the politicians are trying to push.
Before I go to John, then, Stephen, tell us what's likely to be happening soon with those monuments. I think the Trump administration is announcing their plans, essentially.
Yeah, there was a leak just yesterday of the Department of the Interior strategic plan for doing all the horrible things that Scott was talking about, and they may simply eliminate these new national monuments. It's largely retribution because Democratic presidents established them, although virtually every president has used the Antiquities Act to establish national monuments. So rather than eviscerating Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, they may try to just eliminate them entirely and open them up for mining and development and extractive industry. And evidently the plan is going to be announced in full over the next several weeks. And it just makes me sick to my stomach.
So John Ruppel, same question to you. Where do you think Conservation Utah is headed? What's on your mind in this heading?
You know, Tom, I'm trying to be optimistic. I'm trying to find glimmers of hope here. And I think I agree with both Stephen and Scott that I don't think we should expect any kind of large conservation wins in the next 4 years. And the one possible exception I see out there is around the Great Salt Lake. I know this isn't really kind of what we've been talking about in terms of public lands, but I think there's near universal recognition that we need backs with it to avoid an environmental catastrophe there. And I'm optimistic because the answer is really simple. All we have to do is get water to the lake. You know, I know that sounds kind of naive, and it's going to be very, very difficult to do that, you know, because that water is going to have to come from someplace else. But I am optimistic because there's this coalition, because, you know, it's not just environmentalists, it's also industry, faith leaders, government, public that are standing up and saying, we've got to do something, we've got to do something, we've got to do it quickly. So, you know, not all are leaning in equally or enough, but at least we're moving in a direction that gives me some hope. As I think about public lands, you know, I'm a lot less optimistic. I think, you know, as we've heard, the Trump administration is pretty focused on development. They see public lands as a raw material rather than something that has intrinsic value in and of itself. I think there are a lot of state leaders that appear to share that vision. With that said, I think, you know, progress is possible. It's going to look different than it did a couple of years ago. Organizations like SUA are almost certainly going to have to rally to the defense of national monuments. As Stephen pointed out, you know, we see those on the target list, and it's most likely we're going to have to see actions impacting both barriers and the Grand Staircase within the coming weeks. So I think we're going to see those kinds of fights. Maybe there's a win in beating back bad federal decisions. Maybe there's a win in strengthening support for our public lands. Maybe there's a win in strengthening institutions that promote a thoughtful public land management. And maybe that's where we're going to have our success. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's also a way to make, you know, lemonade out of lemons here. The Trump administration's taken a chainsaw of environmental regulations for public lands and to the agencies that we've tasked with administering what belongs to all Americans. So I think it's essential to understand that regulations fill a gap around how our laws are meant to apply. You know, they're kind of the rules of the road. So maybe the administration will succeed in repealing some of those regulations, but they're not, unless inclined to believe that they're going to have a lot of success in repealing the underlying law. So maybe that gives us an opportunity as we think about building back. Maybe there's an opportunity to build back in ways that reflect current needs, current priorities. You know, oftentimes when we're talking about public lands, we're talking about the laws that impact their management. We're looking back, you know, 50 years, or, you know, in the case of the general mining law, we're looking back to 1872 and the end of the Civil War. So maybe this is an opportunity, as hopefully as we move out of the Trump administration, to think about, you know, the values that we hold dear, the laws, the regulations needed to effectuate those goals, and we can build back with something stronger.
I wanted to focus. So John's focusing, finding some hope in a kind of a little more longer term. Scott, I'd like to focus back on just the immediate near term. If the Trump administration moves ahead with this, it sounds like perhaps not just kind of a back and forth, expanding national monument, reducing them, maybe eliminating Bears Ears, for example. What does that fight look like for those who do not want that action?
Well, I mean, you know, right now you've got the Trump administration that is both trying to tear apart public lands with these decisions, but also to tear apart the agencies. At the same time, you've got the Utah congressional delegation trying to overturn decisions that were made, such as providing some balance with off-road vehicles for Labyrinth Canyon, recent decisions about Glen Canyon. And so the threats are enormous. There are a lot of ugly fights ahead, but for my part, and I don't speak for anyone but myself, I do have faith in the wilderness movement and my colleagues at SUA to put up a strong line to stop these actions. And what I think we've seen over and over is that you sometimes, when you can hold the line, you get these breaks. You know, a lot of what's going to happen is going to be dependent on the price of commodities that are difficult to predict. This is an administration that operates by chaos. I mean, you've got Musk on his way out. There will be, at times, an overreach and even an incompetence by this administration where it will undermine itself. And those will be the breaks that activists create themselves by providing the resistance to what this administration is trying to accomplish. You know, specifically with the monuments, the difficulty is that while Trump's action will be illegal, we've seen how slowly the courts can respond. You know, the issue would be resolved with legislation that the Utah delegation has talked about, but they've always been refused to take steps to legislate new monuments. And so I think you're likely to see, you know, this play out in the next administration, regardless whatever Trump does here.
Well, we've reached almost the end of the program here. The conversation's gone quickly, as we thought it would do. So about 3 minutes left. I'll give each of you about a minute to sum up. I'll start. We'll end with Stephen. We'll start with John. Maybe focusing on this, what should the priorities be going forward?
It's a great question, but I think it's really tough. I don't have a perfect answer. But I'd start by saying democracy is not a spectator sport. History provides a strong caution against waiting for somebody else to stand up and make your case for you. So I think in terms of actions, you know, your listeners need to write your senators, write your member of Congress, tell them what you think, tell them what you want. You know, I'm not sure they're going to listen, but I am certain that if we don't tell them what they want or what we want, they're not going to hear. They're not going to hear unless we speak up. So I think that's the starting point. I think, you know, again, I think we need to support the rule of law. I think we have to support decisions that are grounded in science and the best available information. We have to promote transparency. And, you know, I think we just have to keep working. That in the end, we just have to keep going and push. And some of the victories are going to be small, but I think there's a lot of possibility in the moment.
All right, Scott Groney, priorities for the future, the 30 seconds to a minute.
Well, I think just what I would say is there will be this movement of resistance to Trump. We're unfortunately going to waste the next 4 years not only just not doing anything to resolve climate change, but we're actually going to take steps backwards. There will certainly be this effort to undermine all the protections gained for Utah. And I think I would close just to say thank you to all the people that show up for the rallies, for the folks that are going to be in the courts, for the people that are going to organize, people out on the land. That is what it's going to take, is everyone to come together to resist the Trump administration. And I thank them all for doing so.
Stephen Trimble, about a minute here. You'll have the last word.
I think Scott nailed it in thanking the people that are resisting. You know, this is going to take the people pushing back against those people in power right now. You know, nearly 80 years ago, Bernard DeVoto, who was born in Utah, wonderful writer and historian, wrote an influential essay called The West Against Itself. And we're still having that battle where the people and their elected politicians are at odds. And what I think we need to do as the conservation community, as the writing community, as citizens, is to push back and talk to each other, to tell the truth, and to just raise the level of our social capital, the kinds of things that we need to do to just keep talking with each other and having conversations all across the board, from the far right to the conservation community, to indigenous voices. It's crucial for us to recognize that we are in this together and that there's a lot of common ground. And the only way we can do that is to talk with each other and see each other. And as we do so, we eventually will refuse to keep reelecting these same officials that are at odds with the future, at, you know, denying climate change in favor of corporations. We will recognize that civil servants are heroes and are there and as lifelong public servants to protect the land we all love and cherish together. And we need to reevaluate why we need that robust federal presence here in the West to protect the land and end the war against ourselves that DeVoto talked about so long ago.
All right. Well, we've reached the end of our Earth Day program for this year. We've been talking with writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. Stephen, thank you so much.
Delighted to be here, Tom. Talk to you next year.
Talk to you next year. We've been talking with Scott Groening, formerly, recently retired as executive director of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. And we've been talking with John Ruppel, director of the Wallace Stegner Center's Law and Policy Program at the University of Utah. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tom, and thank you to all the listeners.
Yes, thanks, everybody, and thanks for listening to Access Utah.
In this interesting blue sky and variable cloudiness, as we hold on dearly to all the things that people gave their lives for and are still working so hard for, we look to the skies, Venus and Saturn in the morning with the moon nearby. In the evenings, Jupiter, Mars, Castor, and Pollux hang in the cosmic mix just after dark. High above the Big Dipper late these evenings, nearly crossing the zenith, are three pairs of dim, sublime, naked-eye stars, all marking the Great Bear's feet. They're also known as the Three Leaps of the Gazelle from early Arab lore. They form an east-west line that lies roughly midway between the bowl of the Big Dipper and the sickle of Leo, so have a look for these cosmic cue balls dancing in space. Also, the long, dim sea serpent Hydra snakes far across the southern sky. Find his head, a rather dim pattern in the southwest. Hydra's tail stretches all the way to Libra, rising in the southeast. There's some nice, sublime blue stars in there. Also in our solar system, while we're in the area, let's check out Mars's two moons, Deimos and Phobos. They were discovered in 1877, both of them. Phobos is only 15 miles across and orbits just 3,700 miles from Mars. Deimos is just 9 miles wide and only 14,000 miles out from Mars. Their origins remain mysterious. They might have been part of the moon, or there might be a couple of moons that ran into each other, but we might find out more as we go along. Scientists believe that Phobos is spiraling toward Mars, though, and in another 50,000 years could be pulverized by the planet's gravity. Deimos, however, is pulling away from Mars and could eventually go rogue. Go, Deimos, go! And from a fresh Stardate magazine this week, see a rare photo of the rogue from this magazine. Deimos, the smaller of the two moons, as it floats weirdly above the red planet in March. This photo is sublime. This photo is from Hera, a European spacecraft that is en route to an asteroid out in the belt. Hera used Mars's gravity to cut its travel in time by months. Again, Deimos is just 9 miles wide. And the latest Perseverance state-of-the-art rover from JPL has been exploring like a park ranger geologist, and a short while ago climbed over the rim and is searching for more evidence of past life, and just maybe there are some ghosts hanging around. For fun, I'll loan you my videotape of late 70s, I think it was 1976, TV adaptation of Ray Bradbury's famous book, The Martian Chronicles, with Rock Hudson, Darren McGavin, and Bernadette Peters, where they encounter Martians who kind of hang out in another dimension and visit the visitors from Earth at times and get into trouble with the Earthlings, of course. And as it is one sky, many cultures, let's look at spiders. This is from Susan Seddon-Boulay in Pomegranate Cards. Its symbolism is protection and wisdom. Spiders are found throughout the world and appear in the legends of nearly all peoples. They are frequently depicted as helpers, protectors, and creators. The Ojibwa hang hoops of spider webs over their infants to protect them from the harmful influences. Maybe that's where dream catchers came from. There's a spider nebula or two as well in the deep space as well. Check out a very neat image or two. There's actually two on the Skywatcher Facebook page, as well as other photos from NASA, JPL, and other information, and a short blog, and listen to UPR, KRCL, KZMU, and the podcast, and see it in the Wayne Garfield County Insider newspaper delivered to every post office box in these counties. And keep looking up. Look around and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.